سبا كنج بهاري غوپا جايا رادھا مادھوا كنج بهاري Jana Vallabha Giribara Thari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Giribara Thari Sharanandana Prajajana Ranjana Jashodanandana Prajajana Ranjana Jamuna Tira
Anantikoti Vaishnavarindiki. Yoh Premanandi.
Giriraj Maharshi ki Maharaj ki jai. Shambhita Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bol. Here you go. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. You know that, how they light the Aruni sticks and all that? We need to get that down. Ye tvaksharam manir desham avyaktam paryupasate sarvatragam machintyam cha kutastam machalam dhruvam sanniyam yendriya gramam sarvatra samabuddhayaha te prapnubanti mameva sarvabhuta hite rataha. But those who fully worship the unmanifested, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, fixed and immovable, the impersonal conception of the absolute truth. By controlling the various senses and being equally disposed to everyone, such persons engaged in the welfare of all at last achieve me. But then there's the next verse. This is the actual one. Klesho tikataraste sham avyakta sakta chetasam. Avyakta higatir dukkam dehavadbhir avapyate. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. Purport. The group of transcendentalists who follow the path of the inconceivable, unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme Lord are called Jnana Yogis, and persons who are in full Krishna consciousness, engaged in devotional service to the Lord, are called Bhakti Yogis. Now, here the difference between the Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga is definitely expressed. The process of Jnana Yoga, although ultimately bringing one to the same goal, is very troublesome. Whereas the path of Bhakti Yoga, the process of being in direct service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is easier and is natural for the embodied soul. The individual soul is embodied since time immemorial. It is very difficult for him to simply theoretically understand that he's not the body. Therefore, the bhakti yogi accepts the deity of Krishna as worshipable because there's some bodily conception fixed in the mind which can thus be applied. Of course, worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his form within the temple is not idol worship. There is evidence in the Vedic literature that worship may be saguna and or nirguna of the Supreme possessing or not possessing attributes. Worship of the deity in the temple is saguna worship, for the Lord is represented by material qualities. But the form of the Lord, though represented by material qualities, such as stone, wood, or oil paint, is not actually material. That is the absolute nature of the Lord. Om Jnana Timiram Tasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah. Shri Chaitanya Mano Bistam Sthapitam Jena Bhutale Shayam Rupa Kada Mayam Tathati Shupatantikam Mandeham Shri Guru Shri Jatapada Kamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Shagrajatam Sahagana Raganatan Vitamstam Sajivam Shadvaitam Shavatutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Shahagana Balita Sri Vishakan Vitamstam Hey Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kamshana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vansha Kopitrubhyascha Kripa Sindho Bhyevacha Patita Nam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namo Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Shri Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Kresho Dikitaraste Sham Avyakta Sakta Chaitasam Avyakta Higatir Dukkam Deha Vadbira Bhapyate. When Arjuna asked which is better, the impersonal path or personal, Krishna once said personal. Personal is better. But then he gives, all right, the impersonalists, bahunam janmanam ante, after many, many births of cultivating knowledge, they can also attain to me. Gyanavan mam prapadyate. Finally, they'll also come to the conclusion and they'll surrender to me. Vasudeva sarvamiti. Samahatma Sadulava, but among the impersonalist philosophers, to find such a Mahatma is not a very common thing. Mostly they get stuck in their impersonal philosophy, and so it takes them many, many, many births. The point is made that it's easier. The bhakti yoga system is superior, and it's also easier. To fix the mind on something impersonal is very difficult. Avyakta sakta means attached to that which is unmanifested. How do you attach yourself to something that's unmanifested? It's very, very difficult. Prabhupada said we can think of the sky, of a small child we can think of on and on and on, but to think of the sky, the blank sky, is very difficult. Very, very difficult. So it's easier to think of the personality of Godhead, and the personality of Godhead is also superior. Later we'll find Brahmano hi pratishtaham. Krishna says, I'm the basis of the impersonal Brahma. The Mayavadis try to make out that there's Saguna Brahma and there's Nirguna Brahma. And the original is the Nirguna Brahma. And from the Nirguna Brahma, when you put you stick some material qualities on it, then you get Saguna Brahma. So they've got like two different Brahmas. The first class one and the second class one. And the second class one is more or less imaginary. But in the Vedas it said, Eka Brahma Dutiya Nasti, there's only one Brahma. So where do they get this two Brahmas from? In the Bhagavatam, Tatvam Yajganam Advayam, there's only one Brahma, but he's understood Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavaniti Shabdite from three angles of vision. But not that there are two different Brahmas. Ganam Advayam, only one. Also, it's very difficult to make out how a Brahma which is Saguna, which is Nirguna, which has no form, no qualities, no personality, no nothing, would expand into anything else. For what reason? And by whose desire? Because desire is a guna. And where would the Nirguna Brahma get the desire to expand? Although it's said, what is that? Eko Boho Syam. That I'm one, but I'll become many. But why would the one, having no desire and no qualities, become many? There's not much sense there. In fact, the entire idea of Nirguna, Baladeva Vidyabhushan says, actually makes no sense because it doesn't denote anything. You denote something as a table or a chair or a pen because it has some sort of qualities by which you can understand that it's a table or a chair or a pen.
But when you say this is something which is nirguna, what are you saying about it? He says it's meaningless. You're not saying anything. So to fix the mind on something meaningless is not recommended. The form of the deity in the temple is saguna in the sense that the qualities of the Lord are manifested, and they're manifested in a way that we can see, because we can only see the material elements. Prabhupada explains, a crude example may be given here. We may find some mailboxes on the street, and if we post our letters to those boxes, they will naturally go to their destination without difficulty. But any old box or an imitation which we may find somewhere, which is not authorized by the post office, will not do the work. Similarly, God has an authorized representation in the deity form, which is called Archavigraha. This Archavigraha is an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. God will accept service through that form. The Lord is omnipotent and all-powerful. Therefore, by his incarnation as Archavigraha, he can accept the services of the devotee, just to make it convenient for the man in conditioned life that we're used to. So for a devotee, there's no difficulty in approaching the Supreme immediately and directly, but for those who are following the impersonal way to spiritual realization, the path is difficult. They have to understand the unmanifested representation of the Supreme Lord, of the Supreme, through such Vedic literatures as the Upanishads, and they have to learn the language, understand the non-perceptual feelings, which is practically a contradiction in terms. And they have to realize all these processes. This is not very easy for a common man.
People bluff and they you know, everything is one. But they don't act that way. They don't actually have that kind of realization. They're just bluffing. Everything is one. But then they don't eat sawdust. They eat whatever it is they eat. Then what? How everything is one. If they actually had to live as if everything's one, they'd die.
A person in Krishna consciousness engaged in devotional service simply by the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master, simply by offering regulative obeisances unto the deity, simply by hearing the glories of the Lord, and simply by eating the remnants of foodstuffs offered to the Lord, realizes the Supreme Personality of Godhead very easily. There's no doubt that the impersonalists are unnecessarily taking a troublesome path with the risk of not realizing the absolute truth at the ultimate end. They'll be attracted by material qualities. Qualities where to remain stuck to something with no form, no qualities, no pastimes, no nothing, is practically impossible. And therefore, if they reject the form, qualities, names, and so on of the Lord, they'll wind up with the form, names, qualities of the opposite sex. That's where it will finally go. I take that to mean to be the explanation of what Prabhupada meant when he said that Shankaracharya came to increase the unwanted population of the world.
I never understood that, because there's a verse like that in Padma
Purana. Yeah, that's where Prabhupada's quoting. One thought is that the impersonalists themselves are unwanted population. Otherwise, I took it that by preaching an impersonalist philosophy, he's preached a philosophy which actually finally doesn't get people out of the material world. It just, they wind up in bed. That's where they end up. And the result is unwanted population. I took it that way.
But the personalist, without any risk, trouble, or difficulty, approaches the Supreme Personality directly. A similar passage appears in Srimad Bhagavatam. It is stated there that if one has to ultimately surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this surrendering process is called bhakti, but instead takes the trouble to understand what is Brahma and what is not Brahma,
and spends his whole life in that way, the result is simply troublesome.
Beating an empty rice paddy is pointless. All you get for your trouble is the trouble.
Therefore, it's advised here that one should not take up this troublesome path of self-realization, because there's uncertainty in the ultimate result.
The process is troublesome, and doesn't look like you're going to get there.
A living entity is eternally an individual soul, and if he wants to merge into the spiritual whole, he may accomplish the realization of the eternal and knowledgeable aspects of his original nature, but the blissful portion is not realized. By the grace of some devotee, such a transcendentalist, highly learned in the process of Jnana Yoga, may come to the point of Bhakti Yoga or devotional service. At that time, long practice in impersonalism also becomes a source of trouble, because he cannot give up the idea. Therefore, an embodied soul is always in difficulty with the unmanifest, both at the time of practice and at the time of realization. We see that people come to Krishna consciousness, and if they've had long affiliation with Mayavadi ideas, it's very difficult for them to get it out of their heads. They can't actually make the jump. For them, it's too much to surrender to a personality. Or they do surrender to a personality, but they keep within their... They adjust it somehow in their minds that this personality is really a symbol of that supreme, unmanifest, blah, blah, blah. So they can't get it out of their minds. They're stuck with it. So it's troublesome in the beginning because it's so hard to do, and it's troublesome at the end because it holds you back. Every living soul is partially independent, and one should know for certain that this unmanifested realization is against the nature of his spiritual, blissful self. One should not take up this process.
There was some discussion in English literature about someone who wrote a question to a scientist about whether some product could be used in such and such way, and the scientist wrote back and said that the utilization of this product in a manner contrary to the intended purposes could have an untoward result because combustion of such and such could be... Da, 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 da. And it went on, and unintelligible, and then wrote back, and again, unintelligible answer, and then the first person wrote back and said, I guess it's okay to use it. And the scientist finally wrote back and said, no, the damn thing will catch fire.
So Srila Prabhupada does not beat around the bush. Prabhupada says, one should not take up this process. Clear. For every individual living entity, the process of Krishna consciousness, which entails full engagement in devotional service, is the best way. If one wants to ignore this devotional service, there is danger of turning to atheism. Thus, this process of centering attention on the unmanifested, the inconceivable, which is beyond the approach of the senses, as already expressed in this verse, should never be encouraged at any time, especially in this age. It is not advised by Lord Krishna. That's what makes Prabhupada's book so wonderful, that he lays it on the line, makes it absolutely clear, doesn't pussyfoot, doesn't compromise. At the end of this purport, one should have a very clear understanding of which way not to go. That's Prabhupada's way of doing things. I thought I would read something. Sid, you asked me a question the other day about Buddhism. So I thought I'd read you something I've written about Buddhism. Because Buddhism is essentially the same number. Only they say everything is void instead of everything is impersonal. Prabhupada says they're actually better in a sense because they come out right out and say it, whereas Shankara tries to make out that he's not saying it, but he says it anyway. So he's been called a crypto-Buddhist, a hidden Buddhist.
And Shankara uses
Excuse me?
And Shankara
uses the Vedas, so that does provide an opportunity for getting back on track. Okay, info recent. Why do I want that? Let's try info. Yeah, that's the wrong thing. Okay. That's the wrong thing too. Oh, I see why. Because I'm on the other side. Okay. So I've written about how Buddha left his palace. He was a great prince, and he'd been sheltered from the world, and he didn't know about such things as birth, death, disease, and old age. And then he found out about them. And so he, profoundly understanding that these miseries rendered meaningless his life of royal enjoyment, he soon abandoned the palace to wander as an ascetic himself in search of ultimate enlightenment. After years of fasting and self-denial seemed to have brought him nowhere, he sat beneath a tree, determined not to rise again until he had attained perfection. And it was there that in his meditation he at last became the Buddha, the enlightened one. From Bodh Gaya, the place of his enlightenment, he traveled west to Sarnath near Varanasi, and there, in a place called the Deer Park, gave his first sermon, in which he set forth what came to be called the Four Noble Truths. Generally, we just hear that the Buddhists say everything is void, and we don't hear too much more about them. So I looked a little bit more into them, not a whole lot. But the first of these noble truths was the truth of suffering. Life is full of miseries, in particular those inevitably imposed upon us by birth, disease, old age, and death. We agree with that. The second was the truth of the cause. Suffering is caused by desire and by ignorance, which ultimately depend on one another. Ignorance, he said, causes false impressions, which in turn give rise to consciousness, which causes the mind and body. The mind-body causes the sense organs, which cause contact with the objects of the senses. This contact gives rise to experience, which leads to desire and then to clinging. Clinging, we'd say attachment, leads to the will to be born, which then causes rebirth. Rebirth leads to suffering, which in turn causes ignorance, and so we're back where we started. The Buddhists refer to this sometimes as dependent origination, where basically there's no cause of anything. Everything goes around in a circle. There's no original cause, but you start with this ignorance. You can start. I mean, that's just a starting place in a circle. Ignorance, which is caused by false impressions, which in turn give rise to consciousness. Note that little piece of work there, that the impressions themselves give rise to consciousness. That would require quite a bit of work to demonstrate. I'm not even going to deal with that. And consciousness gives rise to the body, mind and body. Well, we could say that also, because in the Bhagavad Gita, adhisthanam manaschayam vishayan upasevate, according to your consciousness, you get your next body. The body causes the sense organs, fair enough. Which cause contact with the objects of the senses, yeah. Which gives rise to experience, material experience, yeah. Which leads to desire, yeah. Which leads to clinging, attachment, yeah. Which leads to ignorance, fair enough. Which leads to suffering. Clinging leads to the will to be born, which leads to rebirth, which leads to suffering, which leads to ignorance, and so on. So they've got this circle. That's their second noble truth. Third is the truth of cessation. Once our suffering will cease when we are free from desire and ignorance. Okay, we agree about that. Fourth was the truth of the way. To reach this freedom from suffering, one should follow an eightfold path consisting of right vision, right resolve, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. These are the way. Such are the noble truths and the righteous eightfold path said to have been taught by the Buddha. The first is of the noble truths. Okay, we live in a world of suffering. Beyond this, however, I don't need that. That's contextual to what the writing's about. The Buddha draws a causal connection between desire and suffering. In this, the Buddha shares in the Vedic worldview, which sees the same connection. Our desires send us running after enjoyment. Whatever enjoyment we find, we become attached to, and our attachments pull us forward into another round of birth and death. Bhagavad Gita says, Purusha prakriti stohi punkte prakriti jan gunan karanam guna sangasya sadasad yoni janmasu. When a living being standing in the world of matter tries to enjoy the qualities matter yields, this becomes the cause of his clinging to those qualities in birth after birth, higher or lower. And so, yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. The enjoyments that come forth from the touch of the senses are themselves the very sources of distress. Not knowing this, being in ignorance, we try to enjoy and so bring suffering upon ourselves. We hear, therefore, both from the teachings of the Buddha and from those of the Bhagavad Gita, that to become free from miseries, we must become free from desire and ignorance. But now the Buddha and the Bhagavad Gita part company, the Gita pointing toward purification of self, the Buddha toward repudiation of self. According to the Bhagavad Gita, I'm covered by ignorance and afflicted by material desires, but by self-purification I can attain spiritual knowledge and transform my desires from material to spiritual. According to the Buddha, however, the very sense of I is illusory. There is no I, no self. From moment to moment, what I suppose to be myself is but an ever-changing assemblage of physical and mental forces. The body, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. This is Buddhist doctrine. There is no actual self. There's this assemblage of these forces which give the appearance of a self. And since they change from moment to moment, there is no self. And so in this view, the attainment of nirvana, literally blowing out or extinguishing, involves the cessation not only of desire and ignorance, but of one's own supposed existence, of one's very sense of self, one's own individual being. When I no longer exist, neither does my ignorance, nor do my false impressions, my consciousness, my body and mind, my senses, and the objects with which they come in touch, nor my experience, nor desires and clinging, nor the will to be born, nor rebirth. This then solves the problem of suffering. When I no longer exist, neither can my suffering. This indeed offers a solution to the problem of suffering, a final refuge from the burden of existence. A self that doesn't exist can feel no pain. Now, I don't know about you, but I personally find this solution, this supposed refuge, exceedingly cold, bleak, and unsatisfying. To get free from pain, from getting free from one's very existence, is like getting cured of a disease by committing suicide. Okay, when you're no longer living or breathing, you'll no longer have the disease, but is that really the way to solve the problem? And I find the Buddhist solution not only emotionally unsatisfying, but philosophically unsatisfying as well. It leaves too many questions unanswered. To insist that an answer lies beyond intellectual conception might work once or twice. But when every fundamental question leads back to silence, we have to ask what kind of philosophy we have. On origins, what does Buddha tell us? nothing exists independently. The existence of everything depends on the existence of everything else. Interdependent origination. Interdependent origination, yeah. Fine, but why should that be so? If that's some sort of law, some sort of universal principle, where does the law itself come from? Instead of an answer, we find silence. Concerning rebirth, again we wind up in perplexity. Since there's no soul, no I, no individual me, I never transmigrate from one birth to the next. Rather, at death, the last moment's assemblage of physical and mental forces, the mind, body, body-mind, perceptions, consciousness, and so on, bubbles up into the birth of a new such assemblage in the next moment. But why then should the new I have to suffer for the karma of the old one? And again, if there's some law, some universal principle that makes this happen, and how else could it, where does that law or principle come from? Again, no answer, only silence. Why even should the noble path of right vision, right resolve, right speech, and other rights lead us to freedom from suffering unless there's some universal law, some universal principle that makes it so? Without such a universal law, the right path might lead to nirvana on Tuesday and away from it on Thursday, or nirvana at 9 a.m., but near miss at noontime. And again, if there's some law that makes the noble path reliably lead to nirvana, must some ultimate cause not lie in the background to make it so? Silence is no answer. Yeah, that's the end of story there. I think I've relied a lot here on Sataputta Prabhu, who made a similar critique of the materialistic scientists, who are often allied with Buddhist thought. There's a lot of attraction to Buddhist thought these days, and for good reason. The materialists are essentially atheists, and the Buddhists are in the same camp, so there's a lot of affinity between them. Both of them are trying to avoid an ultimate cause. The scientists are, and the Buddhists are. And so they find fellowship with one another, and they make the same mistake. The criticism I've offered here is that for all of your stuff to work, all of the norms that you've talked about or regularities that you've talked about, there has to be some enforcement bureau. There has to be some sort of ultimate principle or some principle behind the principle that keeps it together. You know, what makes balls fall to the ground? There's gravity. You can't, otherwise, without gravity, they'd go up or they'd go down or they'd go sideways. There has to be some law, and it's you throw them up on Monday, they go up and come down. You throw them up on Tuesday, they go up and come down. There's a law behind that. So then you have to ask, well, where's the law come from? That question has to come. And Sataputta Prabhu gets into this because the materialists will say, well, it comes from material nature. The scientists will say, well, it's built into to nature. The matter itself is enough to account for all of this. And the Buddhists really say the same thing, or not very different. They're just, it's one thing leads to another thing and around it goes. But Sataputta's criticism of the materialists, who ultimately want to make everything very simple. The Buddhists want to bring it down to finally to a simple point that there's all, nothing really exists. Shunya, that's as simple as you can get. Things don't get more simple than zero. And the materialistic scientists want to bring it down finally to as close to zero as they can get it, that everything finally comes from some very simple something or spontaneously arises. But Sataputta points out that there's two things that you have to have. you have to have laws and you have to have boundary conditions. The boundary conditions provide the stuff that you're going to start with, and the laws provide the rules that you're going to apply to that stuff to make them into something. So, for example, you have a house. So you've got doors and windows and bricks, and you put them all together according to some rules, and you've got a house. And the rules are pretty simple. You put one brick on top of another, and then you put the windows in the empty spaces, and you've got this plan. So you just follow the rules. You know, the people who are the DIY, DIY people, do it yourself. You know, they're handed, here are the rules, here's the stuff. You put it together, it's pretty easy. That means that the boundary conditions, how you do it is very simple. The rules are simple. And that means that the boundary conditions have to be fairly sophisticated. You have to have bricks provided. You have to have prefab windows ready to put in the slots. You've got to have, the tin sheets for the roof or whatever you're going to use already there. You've got to have, all the stuff ready to go. Otherwise, your laws are going to have to become more complicated. If you want to simplify the stuff around you and say, well, we're going to start with sand and silicon and water and fire, very simple elements, then your laws are going to have to be much more complicated. Now your instruction book's going to have to say, mix 5 parts this with 2 parts that, bake for 4 hours, put it aside for, and for the glass, it's going to be still more complicated. All the rules, and then how you make the glass into sheets, and how you trim the sheets, and how you put them into the metal things, which somehow you're going to have to forge yourself in your own factory. All of that's going to start to be very complicated. The rules are going to be complicated, and you're going to have very simple boundary conditions. So you have your choice. Either you have very sophisticated boundary conditions, in which case you could have very simple rules. Even, I know these guys, they put up prefab houses, basically put part A together with part B, add some glue, and you got it. Because the boundary conditions are so sophisticated, the windows are already in place, the floors are already in place, and you just join the two halves together, like Jorah Sunda, and you've got it. It's one simple rule, two simple rules, and very sophisticated boundary conditions. Or you have very simple boundary conditions and tons of rules. You can't really get away from that. The scientists want both. They want very simple boundary conditions. We start off with primordial soup, just carbon and oxygen and this and that, and it just kind of gets itself together. Well, no, it doesn't just kind of get itself together. You have to have sophisticated rules. The information has to be built into the rules now. How to bring all this together and develop it into Homo sapiens and all this other kind of stuff you see floating around, peacock feathers and what have you. You need a lot of rules to transform carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and a few other, ammonia and so on, transform that into what we see around us. You need a lot of rules. Otherwise, if you want to skip a lot of rules, then you have to have very sophisticated boundary conditions. You can't avoid it. And finally, you come down to the question of, where did these rules or boundary conditions, or rather, where did both of them come from? Even if you make your rules as simple as they could be, where do they come from? Even if you make your boundary conditions as simple, where did the stuff come from? They can't really get past this. They're stuck. If you want to say everything comes from void, you're really stuck. Because how does something come out of nothing? If you want to say that everything comes from Nirguna Brahma, you're similarly stuck, because Nirguna Brahma is as close to nothing as you can get. It has no desires. We discussed that before. It has no desires. So for what reason does it expand itself into Saguna Brahma or into anything, into all the varieties that we see here? Why does something which has no desire put that out? You know, I get married because I have desire. I have children because I have desire. I build a temple because I have a desire. Why do I expand myself into all these illusory varieties without desiring to do so? And Nirguna Brahma can't have any desires because desire is a guna. So they're really stuck. They're really stuck. All they do, you know, then they can say, well, it's inexplicable. Well, inexplicable, by definition, explains nothing. You know, you're not saying anything. You're really silent. You're not saying anything. You have a philosophy. What's your philosophy? Philosophy is when you ask us a tough question, we go silent. We say, it can't be explained. It's beyond our understanding. It's inconceivable. Or you go this way, you say, the self neither exists nor does not exist. You know, there's that Buddhist approach to the thing. The self neither exists nor does not exist. And that's supposed to be deeply profound instead of contradictory. And that's how you get around contradictions in your philosophy. You say that it's not contradiction, it's profundity. It's so deep that you can't understand it. Well, that's an old ruse. You know the story of the emperor's new clothes? Yeah. The spinners came and they had this thread that was so fine that only a person of deep understanding could see it. Or they did it the other way. Basically, you know, anyone but a jerk can see this thread. If you can't see it, you must be a jerk. So then everybody, yeah, we see it. We see it. You know, they've got this thing that's so deep and so profound that you have to simply latch onto it. You simply have to realize it. And if you don't realize it, well, it really means you're a second-class citizen. You're a second-class citizen. So not wanting to come out and say, well, damn it, it's contradictory. They say, yeah, I get it. Or else they do say contradictory. Yeah, it's contradictory. And then they say condescendingly, you just don't get it. You know, only after years of practice can one understand. Or, you know, something like that. So they're in the same camp, really, the Brahmavadis and the Shunyavadis. There are some differences between them. As Maharaj pointed out, the Brahmavadis accept the Vedic literature, which gets us somewhere at least. And they accept that there is an absolute truth, but their absolute truth is really not very different from the absolute nothingness of the Buddhists, because they've stripped the absolute truth of name, form, qualities, pastimes, everything. Which is why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu called them aparadis, mayavadi, hoi Krishna aparadis. They're offenders to Krishna because they've denied the personality of Godhead. So there are two problems with the mayavadi philosophy. One is that it's very, very difficult to practice, to realize to attain realization on the path of Nirvisheshvad or Shunyavad is exceedingly difficult. That's the first problem. And the second problem is, it's wrong. Their conclusions are wrong. So you can't realize them because they don't make sense. Or you can realize them. You get yourself a kind of double think by which you can think that the self neither exists nor not exists. And then you can't give it up. You've denied the personality of Godhead so effectively in your own mind that you can't give it up and realize the personality of Godhead. So on both counts, the Prabhupada says it should not be taken up at any time. Maybe we'll stop there, see what kind of questions or discussion there might be.
I had a question also, something came to my mind. I think I mentioned to some of the devotees that it seems in Buddhism and Mayavada, there's all this talk about merging or becoming nothing, but there's no sadhana for that. It's all on a mental platform. It's like the Vaishnava philosophy, the sadhana to attain the goal. But it seems with them, there is no actual sadhana to attain Brahman or to attain Nirvana.
There's all sorts of sadhana.
Such as?
Austerities and Vedic study and all of that.
But simply reading books that will bring them closer to
Well, it's supposed to, yeah. By anivritti shabdat, by hearing, one becomes liberated. So they do have, you know, very, you could say, even stricter sadhana than the Vaishnavas. You know, you have to hear the Vedanta, and you have to study, and you have to live in great austerity. You can't be a householder and do this kind of stuff. You have to be a sannyasi and live on, you know, string beans and... They're very strict sadhana. And the Buddhists also, you know, we hear about the Zen Roshis smacking people on the back as they're falling over in their meditation and so on. Because they're supposed to meditate and they're supposed to meditate and meditate. So they have very serious sadhana. But very difficult sadhana. You know, what are they meditating on? I had a friend who was a cousin, actually, who was a professed Buddhist, which is... he wrote me and said, you know, it's very difficult to keep the self from creeping back in. But yeah. You know, the sense of self keeps creeping back in. And you're trying to meditate on something, you're trying to meditate on the void, and you find yourself meditating on the void. So it's very difficult. That persistent self, sense of self keeps coming back. And what kind of realization? Sadhana is there, but the kind of...
It's a very practical sadhana.
Yeah, it's you know, to meditate on, you know, you get all these koans, sound of one hand clapping and all of this kind of stuff. Does it bring you in, is supposed to bring you to a sudden realization, satori? But that's kind of a hit and miss affair. You know, sit there and suffer for 14 years until one day it hits you. Pretty tough.
Somewhere I read in Mayava, they say, because the so-called sadhana is so tough, so they say it's not, the people following bhakti, it's very simple for them. So
Prabhupada's answer is, why do you want to take the difficult way then? Okay, we're taking a simple way, you're taking the difficult. You know, does that make your way better? You know, we touch our nose this way and you touch your nose that way. You did it better? What is that? The more difficult it is, the better it is, or the more right it is? There was a cartoonist called Rube Goldberg who lent his name, became famous as, because his cartoons were all these very complicated contraptions for doing something. Something would tweak a bird's nose, which would make the bird stamp his foot, which would make a ball roll down a chute, which would make something else happen. You know, and the ultimate goal was, you know, to move a ball from here to there, but you had to go through 136 steps to do it. You know, does that mean it did a better job? Why? Because they have a more complicated or more difficult process. Does that make it a better process?
It seems like all the three, have the same problem at step one with the fact that there's no cause, there's no ultimate beginning to any of their theories or their ideas. Is there anything explained by the bodies, by the Mayavadis, or is there?
Well, the Mayavadis do accept that there's an ultimate cause. Brahma is the ultimate cause of everything. Janmadyasya is the second verse of Vedanta Sutra. They accept, yes, there's a cause. Brahman is the cause of everything. But how is it the cause of everything when it has no... And they get very difficult. Does it transform itself into the illusory energy? In which case, Brahman is transformed, and that can't be right. Or does it expand itself into something other than itself? In which case, you have duality. No, Brahma would be the supreme, but it expands itself into Maya. But how does it, that now you have two things. You have Brahma, because it's supposed to be Sarvakalavidam Brahma. There's nothing but Brahma. So how can there be this other thing called Maya? Well, the cause is Brahma, but now you've got two things. You've got the cause and the effect. But there's not supposed to be any cause and effect in Brahma, and Brahma is supposed to be everything. So they're screwed. Or they take it that there's not really anything but Brahma. We just imagine that there's something other than Brahma because we're in illusion. Then the question is where the illusion comes from. So again, they're screwed. So they do have an ultimate cause. But their explanation of how everything proceeds from that ultimate cause is very problematic, or riddled with problems. Any way they turn, they're stuck. Either they wind up with duality, or they wind up with an illusion that you can't account for. They're stuck. The materialists are stuck. They accept... essentially, matter is the cause of everything. They're shallow. The impersonalists kind of have a little more depth to them. They accept that there must be something beyond matter. The materialists say, well, matter itself can account for everything. Nature is so wonderful. But how did it get so wonderful? Where do the laws come from? Where does the stuff come from? They try to... The sort of goal of what's called reductionistic science, which is practically synonymous with materialistic science, is to get it all down to the simplest possible origins. You know, so the species, complicated species, come from the one-celled creatures, and the one-celled creatures come from complex biochemicals, and the complex biochemicals come from simple biochemicals. But, you know, just take it a few more steps. Okay, simple biochemicals are molecules. Where did the molecules come from? Well, they came from atoms. Where did the atoms come from? Well, they always were. That doesn't work very well. And all right, they always were, but what gave them the notion that it would be a good idea to get together into molecules? You know, we're happy as atoms. Why do we have to become molecules? Well, because of some laws. And where do the laws come from? Or else by chance. But chance, as Sariputta Prabhu points out, doesn't cause anything. It only describes the way things are. That's a... It's not an explanation, it's a non-explanation, it's a description. When you toss a coin up into the air 100 times and 50 times it comes up heads and 50 times comes up tails, you say that there's a 50-50 chance. But the 50-50 chance didn't cause anything to happen. It's just a description of what did happen. It's a description of what did happen. It's not a cause. Like if you got married and then you got divorced, you know, you got two, say there were two devotees, they both got married and one got divorced. You say, well, there's a 50-50 chance of divorce, and that's why it happened. That's not why it happened. That's a description of what did happen, or what does happen over, you know, large samples.
That's not the cause of divorce. It's not that I got divorced because the other guy didn't, and there's a 50-50 chance, and so I had to get divorced. It's not a cause of anything, it's a description. The cause is something else. Men and women have a hard time with one another, or, you know, whatever it is. Whatever causes you might want to find. But just to say that the cause is a 50% divorce rate, no. 50% divorce rate is a description of the result, not a description of the cause. So to say that nature, you know, molecules come into, you know, atoms come into contact with one another and by chance they form molecules, no. You just made the result the cause. Which is kind of cheating, or else just slipshod logic. Take your pick. But it doesn't explain things. Krishna explains things. Aparaspara sambhutak kimanyat kamahoitakam. They say that Isra, that there's what is that? Kimanyat kamahoitakam. Etam drishtam avashtabhya nashtatman obabuddhaya pavavanchu ubhavan. Right, that's the next verse. What is it? Asatyam apratishtam te jagadahur anisha. They say that nothing's real. Asatyam, there's nothing that it's nothing's really true or nothing's really real. Apratishta, there's no basis to anything. Jagadahur anishra, there's no God, no controller. Aparaspara sambhuta, things kimanyat kamohaitakam, things just get together, kind of like the way a boy and girl get together and by chance they're attracted to one another. So the molecules or the atoms or the whatever stuff there is that constitutes the material world, it just kind of gets together in the same sort of way and produces things the way a boy and girl get together and she gets pregnant. That's the kimanyat kamahaitakam, nothing else but that, no other cause. Krishna says they're nashtatma, they've lost their brains. They've lost the plot. Alpa buddhaya, because they just don't have the necessary equipment. And so what do? Prabhavanti ugra karmana. They just create vicious activities, kshayaya jagatohita, to cause destruction in the world. And so you see modern science largely engaged in destructive behavior, you know, so-called defense, or producing unnecessary necessities, finding a better way than nature to do things so that the world can become more hellish. So the Shunyavadis, they say that they're in a different world also. The Mayavadis say, yeah, everything, or the Nirvisheshvadis, everything comes from Brahma, but they can't explain how. The materialists, everything comes from matter, but they can't explain how. And the Shunyavadis, everything comes around in a circle. So perceptions arise from contact of the senses of the sense object, that causes consciousness, that causes perceptions, that causes this, rebirth, da 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 da. Where that all comes from, they can't explain. This principle of interdependent origination. It's a principle of some sort. So if it's a principle, what enforces the principle? There has to be a meta enforcement. The principle that doesn't cause itself to exist. So when you get to the question of causation, all three of them are in trouble, the materialists, the Buddhists, and the Shankarites. None of them can explain the ultimate cause of all causes. Anadi Radhir Govinda Sarvakarna Karna. We can explain. There's a person, he has desires, and so he does things. He has energies, Parasha Shakti Vividaiva Shruyute, he employs them and he gets things done. That's sensible.
You were saying about the convenient use of the word inexplicable by the Maya bodies, Anirvachaniya. What's the difference between
their use of it and our use of it?
We say, oh, it's a chintya. They say, it's Anirvachaniya. What's the difference between these two terms? Because from one aspect, it made it seem like it's the same thing. We have a problem, we say, oh, it's a chintya for both.
Well, usually when we say it's a chintya prabhu, that's some sort of a scam also.
Yeah, exactly.
But when we say that that's a chintya beda 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 tattva, it's inconceivable, but it's not contrary to sense. You can't fully understand it until you've attained realization. But it's not one might even ask in what sense is it's a chintya? Because you can think of it. It's just not materially chintya. But when you have some spiritual understanding, you can think of it. Achintya guna swarupam. Krishna's qualities are achintya, you can't even think of them. But then how are they qualities? It means by material thinking. Otherwise, what's the use of the descriptions of Krishna's swarup, of Krishna's qualities? Achintya guna swarupam. Well, if they're achintya, what are you talking to me for? Why are you telling me about them? If they're avachya, what are you saying? So they're materially about you. You can't speak about them materially. You can't understand them. Atasri Krishna Namadi Nabhavet Grayam Indriya. You can't understand them with gross senses. But it doesn't mean that they're simply not understandable. Seva Mukhi Jivagos. One can understand.
Sri Srimad was in Karachi once. He was preaching in a university, and someone from the Arya Samaj came and said that the finite cannot understand the infinite, it's not possible. And Sri Ramana's response was, if the infinite cannot explain itself to the finite, he's no longer infinite.
Yeah. Exactly. We can't understand Krishna, but Krishna can reveal himself to us. Otherwise, what's the meaning of all powerful? What's the meaning of infinite? Exactly. Even when you say that the absolute truth is beyond words, you're practically contradicting yourself. What are you saying? Then what are you saying? Or why are you saying anything? We're saying so much, but it's shabda brahma, transcendental sound.
Couldn't that argument be used against the Mayavadis that they say that God is beyond words? Therefore, why read about it in the Vedas?
Yeah.
Vedas is shabda, it's words,
yeah.
It's sound.
You say shabda brahma. If brahma has no qualities, how can there be shabda?
Well, Madhvacharya gives the example. They say satyam jnanam anandam brahma. Satyam, jnana, and anandam are three qualities. Therefore, he said, game over.
Yeah, game over, exactly. Any of the things they, even the quality of having no qualities would be a quality.
Yeah.
therefore, Baladeva Vidyupa says, it's meaningless. This nirguna doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. It's a meaningless term. Like horses' eggs, you know, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah, he's determined. No, life is worth living. This. You give him so many arguments. At the end, he says, "Yeah, but I'm going to kill myself anyway." Yeah. It's translogical, and really, they want to make themselves out to be translogical, logical. Mm-hmm. But then, their logic doesn't really work. And then you ask, well, what's underneath this actually translogical situations, where their philosophy doesn't make sense and still they're going through hoops to try to make it work? It's that they want to deny Krishna. Yes, first of all, they start off with some stuff that's true, which is always enticing. This is a world of suffering. Yeah, that clicks. No matter how much you try, you never become happy by any... That clicks. Or with the Shankarites, you're not this body, you're spirit soul, you're consciousness, that all clicks. So they have something that's, profoundly true. But then it's a question of where they go with that. It really helps to have something deep and true to say. That does make you attractive. But then if you go off course after that, but people don't have the equipment to do the follow-through. They just look at the hook and they don't see the bait. Or the other thing that makes it attractive, first of all, it's attractive because it does have some profound teachings, some profound aspects. And then the thing that's really the engine for it is that you can have profundity without God.
Yeah.
That's what really makes it go.
That's why Buddhism is so popular.
It's
religion without being religious.
Yeah, religion without being religious. Religion without God.
No judge, no jury. Your own judge, your own jury, and your own executioner.
Your own executioner, especially.
Yeah.
I was on a plane one time, and the fellow sitting next to me was kind of happy, that there's this spiritual guy sitting next to me. So I got to talking to him, and he began sort of saying that he was into... different, sort of eclectic, interested in a lot of different spiritual paths. But ultimately, I consider myself a Buddhist. Okay. So I kind of let that go for a while. And, so what are you doing? He said, I'm in software. I said, really? Applications? Programming? He said, not exactly. I said, design, like chip design or something? He said, well, actually we do government work. I said, really? What sort of work do you do? Turns out he designs tanks. We had a little discussion about ahimsa and, how you might square all of that. He felt that the work he was doing made things safer for the people, for the soldiers.
The civilians.
Yeah, I said, man, I look that way to the guys on the other end of the barrel, But the reason I brought it up is
I went to the back of the plane to use the bathroom and left him with a copy of Sri Shopanishad. And kind of walked around a little bit, let him have some time with that. And I came back, and he'd kind of put it aside. And I said, find anything of interest there? He said, it's about a deity. And that was like, it's about a deity means, you know, I realize that you're a Nazi. You know, it was on that level. I realized that you were Jack the Ripper's accomplice or something like that. You know, it's about a deity. And on those grounds, you know, politely, the implication was, and so I'd want nothing to do with your book. And then he told how, because I had a problem, well, you know, what's wrong with the deity. And he started telling about how his father or one of his intimate family members had gone through, maybe both of his father and his mother, had gone through terrible pain. How, you know, some sort of suffering, disease or whatever, they'd gone through terrible pain. And he began to cry. And, you know, if there was a God, how could he let this happen? And so because of his lack of knowledge of how things work, what things actually are, he came to this conclusion that if there's suffering in the world, or if the world is unfair, then there must not be a deity, there must not be a God. And so he took refuge in, you know, a little of this and a little of that, and yeah, I'm a Buddhist, and, you know, not a quasi-Buddhist, quasi-everything, but the bottom line is there can't be a deity. That's the attract, you know, I'll read the Buddhist literature because there's no deity there, but I won't read your literature because it implies that there's a God, and I've had it with God.
Very popular now. We saw a documentary a long time back, myself and our Guru Maharaj, called One the Movie. I don't know if you've heard of it.
One
the Movie. Mm. Actually, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj
was in it.
Sometime before he passed away. Mm. But he was a bunch of amateur guys, never had a film before. They were going to all the different religious people, every different faith, and asking them about God. Mm. There's a few atheists as well, but basically the bottom line of the film is we're all worshiping the same God, all religions are one, this, that, and the other. And I can see what in a time like this when there's so much terrorism going on, and so everyone just wanted to unite each other. And at the end, they gave the last words to one very famous Christian theologian, Catholic theologian, Thomas
Merton.
No, he's dead. Keating, I think his name is, Thomas Keating. He's a very famous Catholic theologian. And he made 4 points. And it was amazing to hear what he said. He said, there's 4 steps to understand God. First, understand there's you and there's... No, 3 steps to say. First, understand there's you and there's him. Okay? Sounds fine. Then you have to understand you are him. And then the third step is, there is no him. So from theism, he went to Mayavad, to Buddhism. And that was the culmination of the whole film. And that film, especially with the Southern Californian crowd, they were like, oh, that is so profound, that's so wonderful. It's such a popular thing now to just say everything's one, but no one analyzes it.
No.
Like you said in the beginning, it's not a practical philosophy. You can't live that philosophy.
You can't sell your film with that philosophy. And if you do, you can't collect the proceeds.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
No.
But it doesn't matter. It can be the most senseless philosophy in the world, as long as God's out of the picture. Same thing with materialists, with the spontaneous generation and all of that. The reductionism. It doesn't matter how illogical it is, as long as we can get God out of there. Then it's something we can take seriously.
Preaching sometimes can be, for some people, it's like, oh,
preaching's a very bad word.
Yeah, they don't like it
to hear. We don't use it anymore.
Oh, I chucked that 30 years ago. It's in our BBT style sheet, preaching. The adjective is preachy.
Yeah.
Prabhupada used it positively, but most of the world is not very happy with the term. Religion also, for that matter.
Seems like everybody's bad impression of these terms and everything.
Well, what's their experience with preachers? What's their experience with preaching? What's their experience with religion?
Abrahamic religions.
Abrahamic, or, yeah, mostly Abrahamic, but others also, you know, there's all sorts of strange things out there. What's their experience?
Sure.
On the other hand, spirituality is, like, intensely interesting.
Yeah.
And the absolute you can talk about.
People say, I'm spiritual but I'm not religious.
Yeah, I'm spiritual but I'm not religious. We can go with that. We don't really mind. And we have all sorts of alternative phrases for preaching, you know. Spreading knowledge, teaching. Because preaching has a bad... Well, that's what you have to do when words get tainted. You have to find other ones. But interest in spiritual understanding has never been more acute. You know, the pollsters tell us that people are very interested in spiritual understanding. They're just not interested in religion. Especially organized.
That's just so hard for me to say. I was never to organize religion, that's why I joined this.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can relate to that here as well.
Mm.
Spontaneous.
But their alternative to organized religion is organized corporate life, organized sense gratification. They don't go for just total disorganization, not at all. And the organizations to which they attach themselves are not all benevolent, all correct. Vicious, exploitive. Havoc wreaking. And then they try to stick it on religion. You know, religion is responsible for all the wars in the world. You know, like World War I, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, so many.
Iraq.
Well, they'll stick that one on religion, but it has nothing to do with religion. What was that one down in South America? Britain sent their last few boats over. The Falklands War. What did that have to do with religion? Yeah, make a list of all the wars and the ones that might conceivably have something to do with religion over the last, say, 100 years. But it's just easy to say, you know, religion's responsible for... Come on, as if greed didn't have anything to do with war. Monopolistic
grab what you can, greed. That's not the cause of war, it's religion. That's what the religion is responsible for the Gulf War. Come on. Yeah, it's a useful cover. That's all. The 9/11 terrorists were known to have been to have gone to a strip club the last couple nights before 9/11. So, you know, choose your story. Either they were fanatical Muslims, or, you know, or something else. But we like that story. It sells well to the public, you know. Fanatical, fundamentalist. I met the former director of the CIA, a fellow named Woolsey, spoke at Princeton University. He spoke on Earth Day, ostensibly about the need for lessening our dependence on fossil fuels and all that kind of stuff. But his real theme was how we had to deal strongly with fanatical, fundamentalist, terroristic, theocratic, whatever it was, regimes. I asked him, I said, you know, there's this expression, call the dog a bad name and hang him. I said, to what extent do you think the American government might have opportunistically used that policy in dealing with fundamentalist, theocratic, so on, regimes? He changed the subject. Quite suavely, he was good at it. He's trained. But it was sort of interesting to watch him do it. He couldn't answer that question straight off, for obvious reasons. Oh, sure. Well, how about non-theocratic, fundamentalist, greed? You know, forget theocratic, fundamentalist. Let's just talk about greed, and more greed. Maybe combined with a self-righteous sense that your nation is entitled to
75% of the world's
resources, and to be the arbiter of how everybody else should conduct their affairs. A sort of corporate egotism, you know, the national egotism, that we're the best people in the world because we're the most democratic, we're the most fair, we're the most, all this other stuff that they teach, drill into you when you're a kid. Yishroham. Yeah. Aham Bogi.
Yeah.
Siddhoham. Balavan, certainly. And Sukhi.
Yeah.
All of these things.
It's perfect.
Yeah. Ityajnana vimohita. Okay, so thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Yirmaj ki.